Our second class is entitled Judges, and today's topic is Jephthah. And our speaker is our brother Stephen Robinson. Brother Stephen.
Well, good morning. Good morning. We've come to the end of our study. Today we're going to be looking at the last of the four judges which are mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11. And just a reminder that this week we've been trying to ask the question, why were these particular men, these four judges, mentioned in the chapter of the faithful, in God's Hall of Fame of Faith? So before we actually dive into the life of Jephthah and try to consider this question, I want to just give a bit of an overview of where Jephthah fits into the period of the judges. And maybe I should have done this at the very beginning. And when you look at this period of the judges, what's nice about Jephthah is he actually gives us a timing point. We don't have this anywhere else in the book of Judges. But in Judges chapter 11, verse 26, he tells us that it's been 300 years since Israel came into the promised land. And with that date, you can start to work out, along with some others, where exactly Jephthah fits in. And really, the key reference for trying to work out these time periods is in 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 1, where we're told that it's been 480 years, and this was in the days of Solomon, since Israel came out of Egypt. And then you can work out there was 40 years of wilderness wanderings, 300 years until the time of Jephthah. We know that David reigned for 40 years in 1 Kings 2 and verse 10. And the challenging one, actually, if you're looking, is to find out how long does Saul reign for? And in Acts, we're given, interesting, in the New Testament, we're given that little piece of information that he reigned for 40 years as well. And so we can work out where exactly Jephthah fits into this time period. And from this, you can also work out how long this time period was. About a 357-year period for the time of the judges. And so when you flip back through to the list of judges, which we did look at briefly, and you add up all the time periods that are given, 40 years for Othniel, and they served Cushan-Rishathaim for 8 years, and you add up all of those numbers, that actually adds up to a larger number than 357. You get about 410 years. So obviously, in the time period of the judges, there's a little bit of overlap, which isn't maybe all that surprising, because they are dealing with very particular regions in the land. So that's the timeline, and that's where Jephthah fits in. He's towards the end of this time period. And if you look a little bit at the geography here, what we have, and it's interesting to notice what was going on. So if you flip back to Judges chapter 10, in time period of Jephthah, this was the details, this was what was happening. If you look at verse 6, it says, "And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, and served Balaam and Ashtaroth and the gods of Syria, and the gods of Zidon, and the gods of Moab, and the gods of the children of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines, and forsook the Lord, and served not him. And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and to the hands of the children of Ammon." And so what we find out is on the west, we have the Philistines that were oppressing Israel. And on the east, we have the children of Ammon that were oppressing Israel. And Jephthah is dealing with the Gileadites, which is on the other side of Jordan. And so they were being affected by the Ammonites. So what we're dealing with is a slightly different geography, different region. This is on the other side of Jordan. Whereas most of the other judges are dealing with the west side of Jordan, here we are on the east side of Jordan. And I've labeled on the map here in the north, this is, you can see Tob up there, and that's where Jephthah fled to after he was kicked out of his family. So that's the geography, that's sort of the timeline of where Jephthah fits into this time period. Let's now dive into his life. So we turn back to Judges chapter 11. Starting at verse 1, it reads, "Now Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty man of valor, and he was the son of an harlot. And Gilead begat Jephthah. And Gilead's wife bare him sons, and his wife's sons grew up. And they thrust out Jephthah and said unto him, Thou shalt not inherit in our father's house, for thou art the son of a strange woman. Then Jephthah fled from his brethren and dwelt in the land of Tob. And there were gathered vain men to Jephthah and went out with him." These verses don't say very much but they tell us a lot about Jephthah. We're told that Jephthah was the son of an influential father, but he was also the son of the wrong mother. His mom was a harlot. His mom was a prostitute. And it seems that Gilead fully acknowledged that, yes, Jephthah was his son, and he took Jephthah into his house and raised him as his son. And Jephthah developed at this time into a mighty man. But Jephthah never could quite escape from the fact that his mom was not Gilead's wife. His mom was a harlot. You know, it wasn't his fault. There was nothing he could do about this. That's just the way it was for Jephthah. It seems likely from the way this is written that Jephthah actually was probably Gilead's firstborn son, because it talks about all his other brothers growing up. His other brothers, the true sons of Gilead, the sons of Gilead and Gilead's wife. But if Jephthah was the firstborn, really he should have been the one to inherit the double portion, the inheritance of the firstborn. But it seems that when his father died, that his other brothers decided that he was the son of a harlot, he didn't deserve to inherit with them, and so they kicked him out of his house, and he had to flee to Tob. So Jephthah fled north, and he gathered a group of men around him. Now these men are described in verse 3 as vain men. And if you look it up, the word means empty. Some translations translate this as worthless men. So he was surrounded by a bunch of empty, vain, worthless men, outcasts from society. And you can imagine what these men were like. Probably not the best spiritual support. And they survived. They survived by raiding, by going in and out and fighting and capturing goods for themselves. Now that's a pretty tough background. That's a tough life. And you have to ask the question, how would that affect you if you were Jephthah? What would your outlook on life be if not only were you ostracized your entire life because of who your mom was, but when your dad dies, you get kicked out of your family because they didn't want to share the inheritance with you, and forced to live a life of scavenging with the lowest of the low in society. You know, if there was anyone who might have been overwhelmed by the circumstances of life, it was Jephthah. If there was anyone who might have been bitter against the God of Israel, it was Jephthah, because for him, life just wasn't fair. But all of these events in life are just that. They're events. They're circumstances. This was the hand that Jephthah was dealt with. And we've all been given circumstances in life, events, certain challenges that we have to deal with. Some people are given more challenges than others. Some are given less. And that's simply the way it is. But what we all can control is our response to the circumstances of life. We have a choice about how we respond. So how did Jephthah respond to the hand he was dealt? Well, we're not told. But we can figure out a few things. So notice something. Jephthah was described to us as a mighty man of valor. And around him were gathered a group of vain, empty fellows, and they made a life of raiding. So it seems that Jephthah actually was quite skilled as a military commander. He had a reputation for his valor. He had turned this ragtag bunch of men into a reasonably powerful fighting force. And now you might have thought that Jephthah, okay, he has a somewhat powerful fighting force. They make their living by scavenging, by raiding. You know, maybe he might take the opportunity to go and maybe exact a little bit of revenge on his family in Gilead. Maybe direct his raids against them. Doesn't seem he did this. Seems like he had almost no contact with his father's house after this. And we read about this as the story continues in verse 5 of Judges chapter 11. It says there, "And it was so that when the children of Ammon made war against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to fetch Jephthah out of the land of Tob, and they said unto Jephthah, Come, and be our captain, that we may fight with the children of Ammon. And Jephthah said unto the elders of Gilead, Did not ye hate me, and expel me out of my father's house? And why are ye come unto me now, when ye are in distress? And the elders of Gilead said unto Jephthah, therefore we turn again to thee now, that thou mayest go with us and fight against the children of Ammon, and be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. And Jephthah said unto the elders of Gilead, if ye bring me home again to fight against the children of Ammon, and the Lord deliver them before me, shall I be your head? And the elders of Gilead said unto Jephthah, the Lord be witness between us, if we do not so according to thy words. Seems that Jephthah really didn't have a whole lot to do with the men of Gilead until they came calling for his help. And this would have been absolutely the perfect time to stick it to them, to get his revenge on them for what they had done to him. You want me to help you now? Huh, good luck. Why should I risk my life for you? No, his response actually is quite interesting. And there's a spiritual side to Jephthah that we see here. See, Jephthah, I think, realized that his skill, his survival, his success didn't come from his power. It came because God was working with him. And he was going to succeed here was because God would deliver their enemies into his hand. So what guarantee did Jephthah have that the men of Gilead wouldn't just kick him out again after this all was over? Nothing. Except that God would be a witness if they didn't keep their word. And that was enough for Jephthah. Jephthah had obviously realized that what mattered wasn't the circumstances or the odds that were stacked against him. What mattered was what God was going to do and whether he was on God's side. Now, I don't think this was just a perspective. I think this was a way of life with Jephthah. This was an attitude of mind that he had developed. It's interesting, verse 11, it says, then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and captain over them, and Jephthah uttered all his words before the Lord in Mizpah. He uttered all the words before the Lord in Mizpah. Now, Mizpah means watchtower. And there's a lot of Mizpahs that you run across in the Old Testament. But this might actually have been the original Mizpah. It's in about the right location. Mizpah got its name in Genesis chapter 31. You might want to turn there for a moment. Genesis chapter 31. This is the story of another brother who felt like he had been mistreated. It's a story of a man who had to flee from a brother because of a conflict over an inheritance. And it's a story of a man who now was also returning home again. This is the story of Jacob. And he's on his way home. And notice verse 25 of this story, where they camped. It says, then Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mount, and Laban with his brethren pitched in the mount of Gilead. Interesting. And as we go through this story, look what happens. Look at verse 45. Jacob took a stone and set it up for a pillar. In verse 47, and Laban called it Jager Shadutha, but Jacob called it Gilead. And if you look at what does Gilead mean, you might have a note in your margin. It means a heap of witness. And Laban said, this heap is a witness between me and thee this day. Therefore was the name of it called Gilead. And Mizpah, for he said, the Lord watch between me and thee when we are absent one from another. This was all done in Mizpah. And a heap of stones was raised there to commemorate this, that God was a witness. It was a memorial that God was witnessing what was going on. How fitting if this was the same place where Jephthah and the men of Gilead stood and asked God to be a witness between their agreement. So, if you go back to Judges chapter 11, you're Jephthah. You've just been given the job as a military commander for Gilead. You have an enemy on your borders. What do you do? What do most military commanders do? So, I mentioned I like comics. Hopefully this is a bit larger. Take a look at it for a second. Okay, so he starts off, this is Calvin and Hobbes. He says, how come we play war and not peace? And Calvin's response is, well, there's too few role models. I'll be the fearless American defender of liberty and democracy, and you can be the loathsome godless communist oppressor. We're at war, so if you get hit with a dart, you're dead, and the other side wins. Okay, gotcha. And they have their battle, and he finishes off with, it's kind of a stupid game, isn't it? But this is classic. There are very few role models among the military of people who are looking for peace. If you are a military commander, what do? What do you think about? How do you solve problems and situations? Well, you solve it by war. That's your first choice, your second choice, your third choice when you're looking at solving a problem. Let's go to war. Let's use force. You know, there's a famous saying that if your only tool is a hammer, everything begins to look like a nail. That's what military commanders are like. They look for a response, and their response of how to deal with the situation is, let's start a war. Look what Jephthah's response is. This is, I think, quite unusual. Look, at least for someone who's been given the job as a military commander. Look at verse 12. And Jephthah sent messengers unto the king of the children of Ammon, saying, what hast thou to do with me, that thou art come against me to fight in my land? He sends a messenger saying, oh, hey, wait a second. Before we have a war here, what's going on here? Why are you coming to fight with me? And what Jephthah does is he starts off with diplomacy. He says, well, wait a second, we don't need to fight. Come on, let's talk about the situation here. Maybe we can resolve this peacefully. This isn't what military commanders do. And he gets a response. And the response was that the Ammonites were claiming a pretty large chunk of land. And so what they were doing here is they were claiming this area from the river Jabbok all the way down to the Arnon. And they were saying, all of this land on the side, east side of the Jordan, this is our land. You've taken it from us. That's why we're fighting you. This is our land and we're trying to get it back. And if you read through this passage, Jephthah takes great pains to walk through the story of Israel coming into the land. And explaining that, no, wait a second, you have misunderstood history. This was never your land. This was somebody else's land that you were fighting with, but that was their land, and you were never successful against them. But Israel came into this land, and with the help of God, took the land from your enemies. And look at the key premise of his argument. Judges 11, verse 21. He says there, and the Lord God of Israel delivered Sihon and all his people into the hand of Israel, and they smote them. So Israel possessed all the land of the Amorites, the inhabitants of that country. So verse 23. So now the Lord God of Israel hath dispossessed the Amorites from before his people Israel, and shouldest thou possess it? And then verse 27. Wherefore, I have not sinned against thee, but thou doest me wrong to war against me. The Lord, the judge, be judged this day between the children of Israel and the children of Ammon. And what Jephthah is trying to explain to them, look, God gave Israel this land. This was never your land. This was the Amorite land. And to lay claim to this land means that you are opposing the God of Israel who gave Israel the land. You're challenging the God of Israel. This isn't my battle. This land was given to us by God. And you're not just challenging me. You're challenging God. Let God be judge between us this day. And at this point, Jephthah has explained the issues. He's explained the revealed word of God, where God stands on this issue. And at this point, he prepares for war. At this point, he goes and he collects an army. And at this point in the life of Jephthah, we have what is probably the most talked about part of his life. You see, he made a vow to God. It's a vow that's often referred to as Jephthah's rash vow. But was it really a rash, thoughtless vow? Was Jephthah the type of person to do things without thinking? And if you look through everything that happened in the life of Jephthah, what you find is Jephthah doesn't do anything quickly without thought or care. He always seems to be slow and deliberate with his actions, making careful, conscious, thoughtful decisions. When the Gileadites approach him to become their leader, he doesn't jump at the opportunity and the job. No, he's slow and cautious. He makes you sure he understands what their real intentions are and what the results will be. When dealing with the Ammonites, he doesn't jump into the conflict and say, all right, let's go to war. He's slow and he's careful. He makes sure he understands the issues and that they understand what this war is really all about. And later on, when he's dealing with the Ephraimites, he's careful and he's diplomatic with them. So why would this incident be any different? Why would we think that here, in this one time in his life, he does something on the spur of the moment? And I would argue that a rash vow is inconsistent with everything else we know about Jephthah. So the reason that we usually think about this being a rash vow is because of his reaction to the results of this vow. His daughter comes out, and he's really upset. So whatever the reason for the vow, you have to account for the fact that this was not what Jephthah wanted. And so the other question that always comes up on this topic is, did Jephthah offer his daughter as a burnt sacrifice? So you have to deal with this one. And so I think there are three key reasons why we can be confident that Jephthah didn't offer his daughter as a sacrifice. And the first one, probably the most important, would God have been pleased with the human sacrifice, with this sacrifice. And Deuteronomy 12 and 31 makes it very clear that a human sacrifice was an abomination to God. It's also interesting that in the Old Testament, we do read about human sacrifice to a particular God, and that God was Molech. In Leviticus 20, verse 2 and 5, God said, anybody who offers a human as a sacrifice should be put to death. Now, who had the God of Molech as their God? And 1 Kings 11, verse 7 tells us that Molech specifically was one of the gods of the Ammonites. That's who they were fighting. Why would Jephthah take on the practice of his enemies? It doesn't make sense. Second, there's a technical problem here, and the problem is that for a burnt offering in the law of Moses, the burnt offering was never female and it was never human. So it doesn't really make sense for this to be a burnt offering. And third is sort of a practical issue. If Jephthah's daughter was condemned to die because of her father's vow, don't you think that she would be mourning the loss of her life rather than the loss of the fact that she would never have a chance to have children, the fact that she would be a virgin for the rest of her life? Seems kind of odd. What's more important, whether you can have kids or whether you're going to be killed? And yet that's what she went and said, let me go and mourn, bewail my virginity, I and my fellows, after this. Not that you're going to kill me on an altar. And it's interesting also, if we come to verse 40 at the end of the chapter, what happens to her? It says that the daughters of Israel went yearly to lament the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadite, 4 days in a year. And you might have a note in your margin there for lament. They went to talk with the daughter of Jephthah 4 days in a year. I think it's consistent with the fact that this was not a human sacrifice where she was killed, but something different. So if you have a closer look at this vow, it really actually hinges on one little word, this difficulty. If you turn back to Judges 11, verse 31, it hinges on this word, and. Then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the children of Ammon shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. It's that word and that causes all the problems. And Bullinger argues that that word and can also be translated as or. And I think when you make that switch, suddenly this makes a lot more sense. Jephthah vowed to dedicate to God whatever came out to meet him, or if it was an animal, to offer it as a burnt offering. If it was a human, it would be dedicated to God. Now, is there evidence for this? Well, I think one of the best piece of evidence is this verse 40, that Jephthah's daughter would be around and that people would go to talk with her yearly, 4 days in a year. And so I think what this seems to indicate to us is that likely what Jephthah was referring to here is that his daughter would be dedicated to God, much the way that later on in Samuel, we find that Samuel was dedicated to God, dedicated to the service of God. And as a result of this dedication, she wouldn't have a family of her own. She would remain a virgin. She wouldn't get married. She would spend her life dedicated to serving God. And in this role, wouldn't it make sense that people would come? The daughters of the land would come and talk with her and be with her and learn from her in this new role. I think this makes a lot more sense of this story and of this vow. But we're still left with this question. What was Jephthah thinking when he made this vow? If it wasn't a rash vow, if it was carefully thought through, what was he thinking? And we're not told, but consider this explanation. If Jephthah was the firstborn, then he should have received the double portion. He should have been the person to take over for his father, for Gilead, and to lead his father's house. And he didn't, because he was forced out by his brothers. I think he really wanted this position and this role. He was well suited for it, to be the leader of his people. So much so that when the time came when the men of Gilead were in need, they went to Jephthah and said, "We want you to be our leader." They wanted him to come back. I think that's why at the beginning of the chapter, when the men of Gilead come to him, he's so careful to understand what their intentions are. And he wants to know whether he really will be their leader and their head. He wanted to be restored to his rightful position. He was very concerned about this. And he wanted their promise that this would be the case. And consider the fact that if he became the leader of their family, if he was restored to this position, then his possessions, this position, would be passed down to his family and to his descendants. But he only had one child, a daughter. And I think Jephthah was wondering what exactly God had in store for him and for his family, what God's plan really was for him. During his years in Tob, he obviously had been forced to live with the unmistakable fact that God did not want him to be leader in Gilead, that God did not want him to have the security and the stability of an inheritance and position in Gilead. I think he prayed about this. I think he wondered about this, but had come to accept that this was not what God had planned for him. And then out of the blue, the leadership position of Gilead falls into his hands. He hadn't gone looking for it. They came looking for him. And I think Jephthah asked himself, what did God really want for him? Was this his destiny? Was this the role that God wanted for him, for his family, to be in this position of influence? And for his family to continue as the leaders of this people. And so I think he made a vow that had more than simply this battle and their victory over the Ammonites involved with it. I think we have here a simple test by Jephthah to see what God was planning for him. And when Jephthah's daughter came out to meet him, it became very clear that God's answer was no. His family wouldn't continue in this position of influence among the Gileadites. And I think Jephthah was bitterly disappointed. And we see that in his response. God didn't want his family to be leaders in Gilead. His lineage, his family was going to die out. His family would never be settled and established in the nation. God had a role for him to play, but it was a smaller role than the one he wanted. And if you look through, you'll find that of all the judges, Jephthah judged for the shortest amount of time. I think Jephthah was upset by this answer, but he and his daughter were willing to work with God's answer, to work with it, and to cast their cares and their desires upon their God, and to trust that God was right, and that God had their best in mind, and that they were willing to work with God and what his role was in any way possible. I think this is the reason why Jephthah was selected to be in Hebrews 11. It's because their willingness to look for and to work with God's plan for them. And it's an interesting lesson for us as well, in that we don't always know what God has in store for us. It may not be exactly what we want, but we need to be looking in our lives for how God is working with us, how he's directing us, how he's leading us, and to use the opportunities that we're given. And it's interesting, if this is indeed the case, there's another little piece of information that's kind of interesting to look at. And you may have heard this before. You see, if Jephthah's daughter was dedicated to God, where did she go? And I would suggest that the logical place for her to go in her dedication to the things of God would have been Shiloh, the center of the worship of the nation at this time. And it's interesting if you go back to this timeline that we have here, and you look at this, you can work out that Jephthah here, he was a judge then, 57 years approximately, before the beginning of the reign of Saul. So if you come over to 1 Samuel 8, we have the people at this time in 1 Samuel 8, they were looking for a king. And they came to Samuel, and we're told in 1 Samuel 8 that Samuel was old, and the people came looking for a king. And he anointed Saul to be king. How old was Samuel at this time? And we're not told the answer, but I would suggest to you that he was probably about 60. You can't prove it, but it's interesting. If you go back to Leviticus 27, there's an evaluation that's placed upon people and at different ages. And from the age of 20 to 60 for men, the highest valuation of 50 shekels was placed upon them. And I would suggest that this is probably the normal working age of people back then, of about from 20 to the age of 60. And at about 60, you're retired. I think Samuel had reached the top end of this range, and he was about 60 years old. His retirement was looming, and the people are saying, "We have a brilliant leader and a judge, but you're 60, and you're going to retire soon. And who's going to take your place?" And they were anxious. "Samuel, we need somebody to step in and take your place. And who is this going to be? We need a king." When did Samuel arrive in Shiloh? Well, in 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 24, we're given a little detail. And I think the ESV is a better translation here. In verse 24, we read in the ESV, "And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her," talking about Samuel, "along with a three-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, and a skin of wine, and she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh, and the child was young." The King James says three bulls. The ESV says a three-year-old bull. And I believe the bull here represented Samuel, that the child was 3 years old when she brought him up to Shiloh. And if that's the case, and if Samuel was 60 when Saul became king, and 3 when he arrived in Shiloh, when did he arrive in Shiloh on this chart? And that would be 57 years before Saul became king. That's exactly the same time as when Jephthah was judge. And maybe Jephthah's daughter wouldn't have children of her own. Maybe God put her in the right place at the right time to be a mother to a little boy who was dedicated as well to the service of God, and who would have been in desperate need of a mom, of a spiritual figure in this household. Or maybe she was simply placed there to help provide the spiritual support of a group of believers to help redirect a nation that was being led astray by Eli's sons. But in any case, she would have had an important role to play here, as God was working and moving pieces around to change the nation, to prepare them for the time when his kingdom would be established in the days of David and Solomon. So what is the lesson we get from Jephthah? Why was he placed in Hebrews 11? And this is, I think, the reason we come to. I believe Jephthah was placed here because in his life we learn that faith doesn't mean life will go exactly as you want or expect. Heroes of faith know that life isn't as straightforward as we may hope for. Heroes of faith constantly seek God's way and God's direction. And it's interesting when you start looking at the summary of all of these men who were placed in Hebrews chapter 11, of Gideon that we looked at on Monday, where heroes of faith, being a hero of faith doesn't mean you won't have fears or doubts. Heroes of faith seek God's direction. Or Barak, being a hero of faith doesn't mean you stand alone. Being a hero of faith means you look for the support, the fellowship with other faithful people. Of Samson, where being a hero of faith doesn't mean you will never fail. Being a hero of faith means you trust in God's forgiveness. Or finally, Jephthah, being a hero of faith means that life won't always go exactly as you want or expect. The heroes of faith constantly seek God's way and God's direction. And it's interesting, when you look at this list and this group of people, And we asked the question at the very beginning of the week, and when you look at the ordering here of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, it's wrong. That's not the order we find them in Judges. The writer of Hebrews switched them around. And why? And so when you see the summary here, you start going, oh, that's kind of interesting. The first one and the last one are sort of the same. God's bookended these two with seeking his direction. And how do we seek God's direction? We seek it through his word and through prayer. And in between this, we have lessons about forgiveness and lessons about fellowship. And it's interesting, when you do a study, sometimes you don't see something right away. Sometimes when you look at things in a slightly different context, something pops out to you. And a few weeks ago, you know, our kids were working on their Peter workbook, and they had questions, and we were doing some extra readings. And you look at these sections a little bit more, and something jumped out at me. I don't know if you notice that when you look at this. Does this look somewhat familiar after this week? So let me change the words around a little bit. Of seeking God and fellowship and forgiveness and seeking God's direction. You can switch the words around slightly. Looks kind of similar to this. How do we seek God's direction? Well, through his doctrine. How do we seek God's direction? Through prayer. That's the four pillars in Acts. Something I noticed recently. It's one of the things you stare at something for a while and you start saying, maybe there's some connections for elsewhere in the Bible. I'd be interested if you have any comments or thoughts. Because you see, in the ecclesia in Acts, it was an ecclesia that was founded on faith. Faith manifested by people seeking God's direction through the doctrines, through his words. It was an ecclesia founded by people in fellowship with each other, strengthening each other. It's an ecclesia founded by people who trusted in God's forgiveness, and they remembered this each week through the breaking of bread. It was an ecclesia founded on faith, of people seeking God's direction through the prayers that they offered. This is a lesson of the ecclesia in the first century. It's a lesson I believe we learn from these men selected to be in Hebrews chapter 11.